Welcome to the Wheels Up Podcast, the resource to help business, executive, and VIP travelers stay safe on the ground and in the air. Join executive protection and travel security specialist Troy Clayton as he shares tips on how to give yourself or those in your care a safe journey, no matter where your travels take you.
So welcome back to the Wheels Up Podcast with myself, Troy Clayton, and Brett Bauman, your co-host. How you going, Brett?
Excellent, excellent. So how are you going since we last recorded an episode?
Mate, not too bad. We've been pretty busy, just running a few things back here on the Gold Coast and a couple of things down in Sydney. Our operations manager's been busy working on a few things down south. So, keeping busy, moving into the Christmas period, but all good.
Excellent. And we've had a few podcast episodes go to air over recent weeks now. Are you getting any feedback from those?
Yeah, actually, one of the podcasts that we did a little while ago, we had Steve Albritton on, and we got some really positive feedback from that one. He was saying that he's got quite a few clicks and listeners that have listened into that. So, it's great stuff. It's really positive feedback.
Excellent, excellent. Well, it's timing then that we have another guest today. How about you go ahead?
Yeah, absolutely. So. Yeah. So running off the back, I guess, well, not so much off the back, but previously we've had, as I said, we had Steve. Today we've got a new guest. We've got this guest is actually an acknowledged subject matter expert on integrated risk management and safety and security. He has extensive experience operating and training and teaching within the security sector. He was actually the first recipient of a Doctor of Criminology degree with a specialisation in security management, as well as a Master of Technology degree in security risk management from the University of South Australia. He is currently the CEO of Risk 2 Solutions, a group of companies that's actually not too dissimilar to Panoptic Solutions with its service provision in the risk management space. He is also an author of at least two books that I know of, and the newest edition being Can I See Your Hands? A Guide to Situational Awareness. So we've got Dr. Gabrielle Schneider. Welcome to the show, Gav.
Thanks, Troy, and thanks for the introduction. Just, I guess, as a point of clarity, my qualifications came from the University of South Africa, not the University of South Australia. Otherwise, people get them.
fair call. I actually Googled the US. And it come up as South Australia. I should have clarified that with you before we got on, but no dramas, mate. But just to confirm that all those qualifications are all yours, and I did read them out correctly. Perfect. So obviously, from the onset, I want to say that Gav comes with a very impressive CV and an excellent reputation within the industry, and it really is an absolute pleasure and honour to have him on the show. So again, mate, thanks for being here.
My pleasure, Troy. Thanks for having me.
So Gavin and I actually, we've got a little bit of history together. We've known each other for a little while now, and we sort of come by a mutual acquaintance who Gab used to train with back in South Africa during when they were doing a bit of martial arts. Now, Gav, I understand you've got a significant martial arts history as well. Can you give a bit of a heads up on that one, mate?
Sure, buddy. So that's pretty much how my career started. When I finished high school, I was fortunate enough to spend the next year living and training in Israel. From that, I've just kept training, mate. I've been able to train continuously now for about 35 years so far.
Yep.
A bunch of injuries, but that's how my career started in the security world too. I started training military and police and special forces operators and close protectors. Got interested in the world of VIP close protection, and kind of my career expanded from there.
Perfect. How long have you been in the security and VIP protection?
So I did my first VIP protection course in 1997.
Yeah, right.
21 years, I guess. Started working straight away. So that's when you kind of put it back and go 21 years. Wow.
you wonder where the time goes, don't you? So obviously this show is about travel safety and security. So, keeping in line with, several subjects that are, close to you as a subject matter expert, I'm pretty keen to discuss the psychology of risk and how that relates to travellers. I guess my first question off the back would be, you know, what is the psychology of risk and how would you best explain that?
Sure. So it's quite an interesting discussion piece. So as you would know, one of the projects and services we do is we partner with the Australian Catholic University and we deliver a postgraduate certificate in the psychology of risk. And it's something that's really closely related to the security profession, even though the qualification, the scope of it extends much broader. So it actually really started for me. I was just always fascinated with the way people make decisions and why they decide to do different things. And some of the earlier examples were, you know, when we'd land up protecting clients and, you know, the clients would try and lose the protection team to prove they could.
Yeah,
where's the logic behind that, you know? Or maybe you've had these, you know, the phone will ring and it's a real threat and the client, you know, starts the conversation off going, money's no object, I just need to be protected. And when you tell them actually what it will cost, all of a sudden they're trying to bargain you down and go, I can't just get away with one or two guys instead of the four guys you want to send. Or
So
that kind of started the journey for me. We got a really good research grant from ACU and spent a good while researching what the psychology of risk actually means. And really, when you look at it, risk in itself is agnostic. It's not positive or negative. We just tend to frame it negatively. And, you know, psychology of risk really looks at the way, you know, we in our own minds make decisions, how we make decisions around others, and then obviously how that happens at a group level.
Okay.
But lots of direct consequences and inferences for the security world.
Yeah, wow. Absolutely.
That's a fascinating field. So Gav, how does this relate to travellers? Because that's kind of the main focus of our audience, and in particular corporate travellers. Does it relate to the travellers themselves, or is it the business behind them who is organising the travel? Who could or should be more interested in the psychology of risk? Or do they have their own... are they all interested in it, and do they have their own sort of handle on it, so to speak?
Well, the reality is, if the psychology of risk is simply the way we make decisions, and how much risk we're willing to take and the way we rationalize those decisions, we work on what we refer to as a triangular developmental approach. So step one is really to get the understanding from your own perspective. If you can't even look at how you make decisions yourself, then you know, it doesn't really matter how effective your corporate policies are, how effective you know, response services are. It does start with the individual. But obviously from there, you know, organizations are nothing more than groups of individuals pulling in the same direction. So if they're not aligned to a common objective, you're not going to get a great result either. So in terms of the psychology of risk, you know, really, even if you put it down, and I'll just give you a quick example of each maybe. You know, very often you look at young travelers, for example, who are what we might deem risk-seeking travelers, you know, who will go anywhere, won't think things through too much. Yet you sometimes say to somebody like that, they'll go anywhere, they'll do anything, and you're like, well, how would you like a lovely holiday in Afghanistan? You know, they'll look at you, God, I'll go there. So, you know, even an example on a personal level like that gives you a good take. On the business side, it blows my mind, and actually a discussion I had with a client not long ago comes to mind, and the topic was actually around doing business in Nigeria. And the discussion was sending a delegation of people who've never been there before. And, you know, we literally just said to him, mate, like, if you're going to do that, just you do need to invest in some security. And he said, oh, no, I've been there five times and nothing's ever gone wrong. And, you know, you guys are just being paranoid. And, you know, when you indicate that, for me, it's just people confuse luck with risk management. And
yeah, absolutely.
There's a very different perspective from, you know, a business traveler who might arrive at an airport, go to a hotel, go to an office, repeat that cycle for 2 days and then go back to the airport, to somebody who's actually going to be out and about with no support behind them. So, you know, and that kind of comes onto the...
Well, sorry, Gab, I was just going to say, it kind of brings it back to that whole, that old chestnut of, you know, I've been there 500 times before and it's never happened. It's never going to happen. You know, it'll never happen to me. But it could be that 501st time that something happens. So it's that same old attitude, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think one of our challenges when we talk about how we relate the psychology of risk and... I'll share a bit about the book shortly because it interrelates to this topic quite nicely, is at the end of the day, if our job, even though security professionals or risk managers in organizations, safety managers, that they kind of have this mentality that they need to protect the people. But the reality is, we can't do it in today's world, and travel's a great example. You know, so many people are traveling domestically, internationally, all the time. They've got to learn to look after themselves, and they can't do that. Exactly what you said, they accept the fact that sometimes bad things could happen even to good people.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Gab, if I wanted to explore my own psychology of risk, where would I start? What kind of questions would I ask myself?
So there's a few different aspects to it. For me, the starting point, and when I sat down to write the latest book, that Can I See Your Hands, I actually intended to write a summary of what we were teaching in the psychology of risk. But to actually realize, hold on a second, it's pointless until we start right at the beginning. And the beginning is the ability to deal with the lower levels of the risk spectrum. So I don't know how familiar you guys are with some of the basics of psychology, but I'm sure you've heard of Maslow's hierarchy.
Yep.
And if you think of Maslow's hierarchy, you've got this triangle with five levels. And at the bottom of the triangle, you've got, you know, the safety and the security levels. And then as you move up, you get to the levels where you focus on more actualized issues, self-esteem, love, fulfillment, etc. So one of the problems we've got when we take first world travelers is that many of them have grown up in a world where they've never had to worry about the bottom two. They've always been safe. They've always had food to eat. They've never had anything go wrong. All they've been worried about is, you know, do I have a great job? Have I found love? You know, does my life have meaning? So the problem is, if people have never thought about the bottom two and they expect to be able to manage or deal with a situation, they're not equipped. So it comes down to luck. And the luck then comes back to an instinctive response, you know, where they might freeze, they might panic, they might fight, they might flight, and there's no ability to control which option they pick if something went wrong, which is really risky when you start looking at it. So, you know, the summary is really, if you look at yourself as an individual, one of the first lessons to learn is a bit of introspective capability around the way you make decisions. And we align that in two factors. One is strategic and one is tactical. And different people are strong in different areas. Some people like to think and analyze and work out all the possible options that could go right or wrong and then make a call. Other people just instinctively make calls. The reality is, if you're traveling on your own and you've got nobody watching your back, you actually have to be able to do both. And I'm sure, Troy, you'd agree that, you know, one of the challenges is we try and get people to prepare beforehand. And even if people can afford a protection detail, which is really outsourcing all their preparation so they don't have to worry about it, you know, a few moments where they're separated from their protection detail could be when something goes wrong.
Absolutely. I mean, that brings us to what we've been doing actually with the pre-deployment briefs, pre-deployment training. You know, there seems to be a bit of an uptake on that from our end for the exact reason you were talking about. You know, not everyone can afford a protection detail. And it's all about just preparing people for their travel. So it's exactly what you're saying there, Gav.
So Gav, is this something that a company could like do an assessment on a staff member who they may be sending somewhere dangerous, do an assessment of them to get their psychology of risk? And then if that assessment shows that they're a high-risk individual, can they then be coached on how to adjust their behaviour?
You can do that. I mean, we're actually busy with a cultural change project for a law enforcement agency at the moment where we're looking at building those core skills within their workforce. But the reality is most organisations don't have the time, effort or energy to do that.
Right.
You know, for us, this is where it's quite interesting that when you look at a specific area, and let's take travel risk as that specific area, the skills I need to manage travel risk are not dissimilar to the skills I need to manage everyday life. They just are compacted into, you know, I leave or I plan my departure, I travel, I get somewhere, I do what I got to do, and then I come home. So you've almost got a smaller scale of any sort of operation, you know, with a pre-departure or pre-planning phase, the travel itself, and then the return. So one of my challenges is trying to, we use the term silo bust. You know, within organizations, there's often a safety department, a security department, if they're lucky. There's a risk department sitting somewhere. There's a governance and corporate oversight structure very often. In other organizations, they've even got travel departments, as I'm sure you guys would have come across. And none of these people talk to each other.
No. Left hand doesn't talk to right hand at all.
Exactly. So for us, you know, the real risk actually sits in the gaps between those silos. Oh. And it's something that we've got to get even individuals. If you think of the way your own head works, you compartmentalize things so that it's easier for us to make decisions. And most decisions are made on, you know, cognitive biases or heuristics, and they're not actually made on facts. We tend to relate known instead of trying to figure out new stuff and interpret it. And as a result, you know, from a travel context, you'll get somebody who goes, you know, I went to Bali and nothing happened to me, therefore, you know, you name the country, insert here. If I go there, I'll be fine. Or, you know, everybody said South Africa was so dangerous. You know, I went there, nothing happened to me, so therefore everywhere else in the world is probably safe.
Hmm. All right. So speaking of South Africa, actually, I mean, obviously you grew up in South Africa. Yeah. So you grew up in South Africa, and obviously the security situation is very different in, you know, places like Johannesburg and Cape Town than, you know, it is in downtown Brisbane. You know, certainly we've operated in South Africa, and you know, we've found the same thing. You know, obviously the security situation is very different. So for you, you know, what did you find was the biggest challenge, I guess, from a business perspective, going from a relatively volatile environment to one which is, I guess, considered relatively safe or benign, even though, you know, you only have to turn on the news these days that, you know, everywhere is starting to become a target in today's age with the threat of terror and lone wolf-style attacks.
Absolutely, and I guess I'll take it back. So I moved to Australia in 2008, got a scholarship to do my PhD then through an Centre of Excellence in Policing and Security, which was Charles Sturt, ANU, Griffith and UQ combined. And I was really lucky in that my main business at that point was still back in Africa. I'd spent 2 months here researching and then a month back on the tools in Africa. And at one point almost felt schizophrenic because you put on a different hat in the different places.
I could understand it, yeah.
You know, you kind of go from leaving the doors totally unlocked and not even stressing in Brisbane to, you know, the very first thing when I landed in South Africa was going to the office, checking my firearm and bulletproof out, and then starting my trip. Yeah. But the reality is, now I think one of the problems we've got is that if you go back to that Maslow's hierarchy example I gave, Australians are really lucky. This is a great place to live. You know, you're very rarely exposed to something, and even those who have been exposed to floods or cyclones or weather conditions or fire, there's usually quite a strong safety net there, you know, where the government, the authorities or the insurers will support them. And, you know, growing up in South Africa, and I've worked in 17 countries so far, most of them third world countries, you know, there's no safety net there. There's no government authority going to back you up. There's no emergency number you can call that will send help. And I think one of the frustrations, and you hit the nail on the head earlier with the way the security situation globally has changed. Now, if we talk about lone wolf extremists, or we talk about mentally ill or unstable persons, or we talk about, you know, persons who are high on ice, for example, yeah, you know, the threat context in general has changed for the average citizen in Australia. Yet, you know, most of them haven't realized this because of the exact example you brought up earlier. If I haven't seen this before, I don't believe it'll happen to me. Yeah. And even if you have seen it, if we look at what happened in Melbourne, or you look at what happened in the Lid Cafe, or you look at the terror arrests that are happening pretty regularly now,
yeah,
the average citizen turns around and is still in a state of denial. I do think there's a bit of a change. And, you know, if I was going to forecast something, I reckon, you know, what safety was in the late 90s and early 2000s, where organizations all of a sudden had to set up safety structures and had to develop behavioral safety plans, most of that is now normal. You know, most organizations will have a workplace health and safety plan as standard. I think in the next decade we'll see that become standard in Australia too.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that security, you know, is going to be exactly what you said. It's going to be the safety of what we've seen in the previous years. You know, I only read recently there was 15 terror attacks that were uncovered, undermined and stopped between 2014 and 2016. And I don't think that, I guess, the general public is aware of these things that are occurring. You know, you've got the intelligence community, you've got the police services doing an amazing job, you know, trying to stop all these things and thwarting what they can. I mean, obviously, there are some that have got through, and you've mentioned a couple previously, obviously, the Link Cafe and I think Curtis Chang and a few others that have occurred. And I guess the general public, it's exactly the attitude that you said. You know, I think Australia is very apathetic to, you know, to the security situation that occurs. I was in USA just recently, and the security situation there is very different and taken a lot more seriously over there than what it is here in Australia, I guess. So yeah, it's two very different attitudes.
And it is interesting, you know, going back to the psychology of risk, focused on that. You know, there's a part of the brain called the RAS, the reticular activating system, and the RAS sorts all the information we have out so that, you know, we don't get bombarded by the thousands of pieces of information we receive at any given time. And it really sorts them all out based on two things. You know, what am I interested in, or what could hurt me? And if you look at the average member of the Australian public, if they don't believe terrorism is real and it's going to hurt them, they don't even see it or hear it. And you know, and on the other side, if they're not interested, which most of them aren't, because you know they haven't perceived that to be real to them. So literally, even though we're bombarded with a lot of the stuff passively, and I think you know the way the media reports on terrorism in its own right is quite a big issue. You know, we've just got this layer of denial filtrating. Yeah. And I think the challenge blows my mind. Maybe this happens to you too. How many conversations I have with clients in government, local, state, federal, it doesn't really matter, who are saying things like, oh, but it hasn't happened here, you know, and only when it happens here, you sort of turn around and you quote the exact statistic you did, right? Hmm. You know, we've had several attacks, we've had 15 near misses, which, you know, thank goodness the authorities were on top of. What do you mean it hasn't happened yet?
Yeah. And you're right, it absolutely has happened. They're just not aware of it or don't want to be aware of it. So, yeah, no, it's a good point.
I guess part of that apathy also, sorry, Gav, you mentioned earlier that Australia is a very lucky country and we're well protected. You just mentioned the 15 attacks that were averted. Those were just terror-related. There's also other risks that companies need to be aware of, particularly when it comes to travel. Do you find that corporate apathy, which is obviously an extension of the personal apathy that people have, do you think that's at a dangerous level here in Australia, or is it just at a level that there's probably no real harm going to come of it? What's your feedback on that?
It's a really good insight and point on that, and I think there's a few things. We out of our risk consulting business do a lot of generic strategic risk consulting. And that we're often doing with boards of companies or senior executive teams around holistic risk, which is not just security. We talk about anything that could go right or wrong for an organization. And one of the challenges I think we've seen is that activities like risk management for organizations have become tick the box as opposed to really adding value. And when you talk about the vulnerability that Australians are exposed to now, you know, One of the big problems we've got is that the threats of today are not necessarily in line with the threats of yesterday. Oh. And Australia, just being an island state, relatively remote, has been able to avoid a lot of issues just because of that. But now business is global. You know, people are traveling all the time for business, both inward and outward. Threats manifest online and virtually all the time. And when we look at the cyber threat combined with self-radicalization, combined with the fact that more and more businesses are internationalizing and are trying to do business abroad, and the she'll be a right attitude risk.
Got it.
Yeah. And cyber is becoming huge. And it's going to be, it's just going to increase as we move forward. So, yeah, absolutely.
So it sounds like they need to make a cultural shift. If I understand correctly, the culture currently seems to be let's cover our ask. And they need to move to let's be prepared. And there's obviously a distinct difference between those two positions.
That's a good summary. I would actually say it's a combination of, we use the acronym CYA, cover your ass, exactly.
Yeah. Yep.
And the other side of it is she'll be all right. What happened to me, it's no problem. And if it does, we'll deal with it then.
Yeah.
Which you know, as you rightfully said, but you know, both of those either sit into the categories of denial or being totally reactive.
Yeah.
And you know, as we know, Troy, I mean, you know, the basis of any protection operation is comprehensive planning and preparation.
Absolutely, so, yeah.
What professionals do, you know, businesses and individuals should be doing that on even if it's on a micro level.
Sure.
You know, just as a simple example, you know, the Australian government runs the Smart Traveller program.
Yeah.
And you know, very few people register. And what's amazed me is often people don't register simply because they actually don't see any benefit.
Yeah.
And you know, part of the challenge is that, you know, being registered on Smart Traveller is not going to save you. But if you're in, the world of trouble, at least somebody knows where you are.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we've been advocating that in a few podcasts that we've been talking about recently, and letting the people, you know, letting our listeners know you really should be you know, getting on there on Smart Traveller and letting people know and logging in for that exact reason. If something does go wrong, then people can come and find you, or at least know where you are and start some sort of search or, you know, recovery on what's occurring. So, yeah. So I just want to quickly bring it back to your book. So, you know, you've got your new book, Can I See Your Hands? And it's all about situational awareness. And it's come out in a fantastic time because it was a subject that we've been meaning to cover. So we won't go entirely into the whole situational awareness today because, you know, we've taken up a fair bit of your time already. But there's a couple of points I wanted to bring up, and that is, you know, what makes for poor situational awareness, you know, specifically in relation to travellers. You know, what leads to a lack of situational awareness, and why do some travellers have a strong situation, you know, a strong sense of situational awareness compared to, say, other travellers?
Cool. So I think the starting point is to actually define situational awareness, because it's one of those jargonistic terms that gets thrown around a lot. And, yep, you know, you talk to somebody who's ex-military, they've got a perspective of situational awareness. You talk to somebody who runs board meetings, their perspective is different. So it's important to get that in perspective. I think one of the challenges for us is that we, you know, being situationally aware means being aware of the right thing. Because we're supposed to be aware of every single thing at any given time. And half the problem is if we don't think anything will go wrong, I don't even have awareness of it on my radar, therefore there's no chance I'm actually going to notice it manifesting. I'll never forget, I picked up a colleague of mine who's an ex-Israeli soldier, a very highly acclaimed self-defense instructor, and he was flying into South Africa to visit us and do some seminars. I gave him a little safety briefing when I picked him up at the airport, you know, keep your windows closed, lock your doors. And as we were driving out of the airport, he was looking around at everyone else, and at least 50% of the other vehicles had their windows open and people on cell phones or distracted. And he went, you know, you've just given me the briefing. Why are these people behaving in a way that's contrary to the threats you've identified? And it just comes back to that level of denial and apathy. So the biggest challenge we've got is being situationally aware takes work and it takes effort. And from a travel context, it means doing a little bit of stuff ahead of time, but it also means identifying the times during my trip where I'm most vulnerable, and then actually being more vigilant during those times, because we can't be vigilant all the time. I'm sure, as you'll be aware, usually those times where we are most vulnerable are times of transition, you know, where, you know, getting off a plane, I'm getting in local transport, I'm getting out of local transport, going to a hotel, because of the destabilization, moving from one stage to another. So even people simply realizing that when I'm vulnerable in those situations, just open up, observe, look around a little bit more and start thinking about what could go wrong. And if you get to your hotel room and you're locked up and you're nice and secure, switch off again. You know, it's okay. At least there's some protective barrier. The challenge of situational awareness is a big one for the everyday traveler, because what security professionals take for granted, the average person has thought about doing. And
absolutely, you know, yeah.
There are certain things like just knowing where the escape routes and exits are in a place you stay, or knowing what the emergency phone number would be in a country you go to. I think that many blasé frequent travellers never bother, because they've kind of programmed themselves to think nothing will go wrong based on past history.
It's funny, you talk to people about this, sorry to interrupt, but you know, you start talking about emergency phone numbers, you start talking about emergency exits, and they kind of look at you strangely. But for you and I, you know, it's, you know, being in the security profession, it's just an everyday thing. Whereas I guess you know, travellers are like, well, I just want to know where the swimming pool is and where the buffet is. I don't really care too much about your emergency exits. So yeah, it's quite interesting.
Yeah, and just hearing the example you gave there, Gav, of where you're driving out of the airport and half the people are driving with their windows down, it shows how much of a difference being situationally aware reduces your risk. Like, these are small things that you can do, because the people with their windows down, they're the ones who are at risk now. You're not, because you can pull up at traffic lights and you can be pretty sure that you're going to pull away without someone reaching in to grab something special to you. It's the other guys who are at risk.
You're exactly right, Brett. And that's one of the challenges. You know, you don't being paranoid is worse than not being vigilant at all, because you work through that limited amount of awareness you've got, you chew through it really quick.
Yeah.
That is exactly what you said. And this is actually one of the biggest benefits we've got, is I don't have to be the most aware. I don't have to be the most prepared. I've just got to be that little bit more aware, a little bit more prepared. We know from your studies in criminology that most criminals select targets based on likelihood of success first return.
Yeah.
And why would I rob you, assault you, attack you, rape you, kidnap you, you name it, if it looks like you'll see me coming, but the guy behind me won't?
It's like the old story of if you're in the jungle, you don't have to run faster than the lion. You've just got to run faster than the other guy.
Exactly right.
That's it.
Gav, who's your target audience for your book? Who do you think should be reading this?
Great question, Brett. So my first book actually was written for CPP and close protection operators, which is a very small market. The challenge I had, one of the triggers in the way I've developed my career has been a personal incident that happened to me when I was a lot younger. I was an Israeli full contact jiu-jitsu champion, working as a professional bodyguard, running a martial arts school, probably physically on top of my game. Got a phone call one night in South Africa, my mother on the way to the hospital. Her and my stepfather just been in an attempted robbery, and he'd been shot in the head. Wow. Got my go bag, rushed to the hospital, found there was nothing I could do at the hospital, rushed to the scene, almost landed up shooting two cops who had looked that they were, I didn't know they were cops, they were playing clothes and they were stealing stuff from the car. And it was literally a split, you know, finger was on the trigger. It was more luck that I didn't pull the trigger and probably good training. It turns out they were policemen stealing from the car, so law enforcement is legal. But for me, it was one of those moments in my life where I turned around and went, you know, it actually doesn't matter how good people like us get, because we're not there when our loved ones need us.
Right.
It's been a bit of a lifelong pursuit for me to try and translate the knowledge security professionals have to a form that the everyday person would read it. So the book is aimed at the everyday person. I get the average punter to pick it up and read it. We also have an online training program to accompany the book, knowing people don't like reading, and you know that the content needs to be delivered in a slightly different way. So this is the knowledge every person should have. This should be taught. Everybody should have fundamental skills. The fact that we don't is a testament to the level of denial we live in.
Yeah.
Wow.
Absolutely.
Wow.
That's some amazing insight, and you know, not just I guess into the psychology of risk and how it relates to travelers, and obviously you know about your book there, Gav, but certainly an insight into obviously your background and some of your experiences. So, mate, a huge thanks from me for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure. And hopefully we'll get another chance to do it at a later stage. So again, mate, really appreciate you being here.
Thanks, Troy. Thanks, Brett. Appreciate the opportunity to chat to you both.
Thanks, Gav. So, Gav, before you go, where can anyone get a copy of your book, Can I See Your Hands? And what's the name of your first book also?
First book is called Beyond the Bodyguard.
Yep.
They can both be purchased direct from the publisher, which is Universal Publishers, or on Amazon or any decent online seller has them. My only request would be to anybody who's listening to the podcast, please, if you read the book and you like it, give us a decent rating on Amazon. One of the things that we're struggling with at the moment is your books don't get promoted unless you get enough reviews on Amazon.
Okay. Yep. So,
yeah, we'd greatly appreciate that. And
well, we urge everyone that's listening to the podcast, the hundreds of thousands of listeners that we've got, I have no doubt, to jump on and grab Gav's book and make sure you give him a great rating. It's a great guy with some great experience, very knowledgeable, and I've actually I've got to admit I've only partially read it, but I've partially read Gav's first book, which he graciously gave to me, it's a good read. So jump on board, jump on Amazon, give him a good rating, and go from there.
Very good. And I'll add it to my reading, to my reading list as well. Sounds interesting. So Gav, if people want to find you, your website is risk2solution. So that's the number 2, risk2solution.com. If they're in Australia, they can reach you on 1-300-459-970. And email address is info@risk2solution.com. Any other addresses that you'd want to give out while you've got the opportunity?
People can just connect via LinkedIn too. So LinkedIn, connect up, that's often the easiest way to go.
Very good. Okay.
Perfect. All right. Alrighty. All right. I'll see you next time, mate.
We'll do. We've got a lot to think about after this episode. It's taken us to a whole different level.
It's been a great one. All right. Thanks again, guys. See you later, guys.
Thanks, gentlemen.
Cheers, guys. Bye.
You've been listening to the Wheels Up podcast with Troy Clayton. For more information, show notes, resources, and subscription options, visit wheelsuppodcast.net. Wheels Up is brought to you by the Experts On Air Podcast Network. Until next time, safe travels.